On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Radiation Risk Assessment, Updates and Tools. Today's training was developed by the ITRC RADS team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's training class. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the next few slides, and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors. As we go through the presentation, each of you in the audience are in control of which slide you're on. The slide number is in the upper right-hand corner today, and the instructors will say that slide number as we go through the presentation. If you're using the clearance system, the series of orange buttons along the top allow you to navigate. The double left button takes you back to slide one. The single left button takes you back to slide. Most often you'll be using the third button, the single right arrow, that moves you forward one slide at a time through the presentation. The double right arrow button fast forwards you to the last slide of the presentation. The house button takes you back to the presentation overview page where we started today. The question mark button is there primarily for a simulcast audience. For those of you in our simulcast audience, you're hearing the sound of today's training through your computer speakers instead of over a phone line. To ask a question, you can select that question mark button, type it in, and I receive that as the moderator. Anyone is welcome to use that at any time during today's presentation to send a comment or a question that I'll receive. For our phone line audience, you're welcome to ask your own questions out loud, but we do ask that you wait till the designated question answer sessions. We're going to have one in the middle of today's presentation and another at the end. Today's training is brought to you in cooperation with the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. They're hosting the CLUIN website that we're using today. The ITRC Radionuclides team developed a document titled Determining Cleanup Goals at Radioactively Contaminated Sites, Case Studies. This document examines the factors influencing variations in cleanup levels in cleanup level development at various radioactively contaminated sites. The document also acknowledges the differences between dose approach used at some sites and EPA's risk-based approach. Today's training clarifies the variations between these approaches and elaborates on the methodology used to develop risk-based remediation goals. If you move to slide two using that right arrow, I'm going to briefly tell you about ITRC. ITRC is a network led by state regulators and includes others in the environmental community. This diverse group gets together and focuses on projects. Often the outcome of a project is a document and a training like today's training event. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States and includes state members from almost all states. Federal partners include Departments of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. For more information about ITRC, please visit the ITRC website, and we've listed that link on the top of this slide. You can learn more about what ITRC does, what other topics we're focusing on right now, and also find information on how to contact the ITRC POC in your state. On slide three, this slide includes ITRC and disclaimer and copyright. We include this information in all ITRC presentations and would ask that you please read over this slide. In short, it says we try to provide accurate and reliable information but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide four, we've planned out our course schedule for 2007. Along the left, we're continuing to offer the courses that we've offered in previous years. And along the right, you'll see the list of new courses that we're going to develop this year and start to offer. More information is available at the ITRC website, and I've listed that again on this slide. I'd also like to point out we have archives of previous training classes, and I've listed the link to the archive at the bottom. So you can listen to a presentation at your convenience. These archives are available anytime that you're able to listen. On slide five, if you joined after I get started, please review the logistical reminders along the left. In today's presentation, we're going to start with regulatory background and case studies, and then talk about human health assessment approaches for radionuclides. About halfway through, we have a break for questions, and we do ask that you hold all of your questions until that designated question answer break. In the second half, we're going to talk about risk assessment tools and application of EPA's PRG calculator. At the end, we'll have more time for questions, and also a wrap-up. As part of the wrap-up, we're going to ask you to fill out the feedback form. So before you leave the site today, we would appreciate you providing feedback. On slide 6, it's my pleasure to introduce today's instructors. All of our instructors are members of the ITRC radionuclide team that's led by Carl Spring of the Colorado Department of Health and Environment and Robert Storms of the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation. Our first instructor today is Carl Spring. He's a project manager at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment in Denver. He oversees environmental restoration at DOE's Rocky Flat site and has been with the department since 1991. Smita Sidante from Indyna Inc., located in McLean, Virginia, is a recognized expert in risk assessment and risk management. She has more than 15 years' experience in managing work related to hazardous and radioactive waste management, human health and environment risk assessment. Stuart Walker has over 19 years in EPA working on regulatory compliance and regulation development. Since 1990, he has worked in the Superfund program and the Office of Radiation and Indoor Air, addressing the cleanup of contaminated sites. If you move to slide 7, it's my pleasure to turn over today's presentation to Carl Spring of the Colorado Department of Health and Environment. Carl?
Yeah, thanks, Juliana. As slide 7 says, the purpose of today's training is to facilitate cleanup by explaining radiation risk assessment approaches and tools. We also want to make the process of setting risk-based remediation goals for radionuclides more consistent. So what do we hope you'll learn from this internet course? First of all, we hope that you'll be able to understand the regulatory and technical basis for the variation seen in remediation goals that have been developed at different sites. And we also hope you can clarify differences between dose-based and risk-based approaches, and we'll be discussing updates to these approaches. We also hope that you'll, by participating in this course, that you'll become familiar with risk assessment tools for calculating preliminary remediation goals for radionuclides. And fourth, we hope you'll be able to apply these calculation tools at your site. We expect that many of you participating in this training will have various backgrounds and levels of experience with risk assessment in general and with radionuclides in particular. If there are some terms or concepts that are unclear during this training, there's some resource materials listed at the end of this training that should help. Now, on an earlier slide, it listed the four modules that we'll be going through. The first module explains how cleanup goals have been calculated at several example sites and the basis for those calculations. The next module talks about the differences between dose and risk approaches to evaluating harm to human health. The third module focuses on EPA's RAD DRG calculator tool. And the last module is an example application of EPA's radionuclide PRG calculator. The next couple slides, 8 and 9, list acronyms that are used in this training, and you can refer back to this list during the course of the training if necessary. Now, Module 1 begins on the next slide, slide 10. And in this first module, we'll be talking about regulations governing radioactively contaminated sites. These regulations sometimes seem complex due to the involvement of multiple agencies, overlapping authorities, and multiple categories of radioactive materials. By participating in this session, we want you to be able to explain the variation in radiation standards due to differences in regulatory authorities. Also, understand that the variation in regulatory standards might require different risk assessment approaches. And last, to learn how cleanup levels are influenced by the particular risk assessment approach used. This module, in fact, this entire training will focus on radioactive contamination. We won't be talking about mixed waste, which merges aspects of radioactive and hazardous waste. Those of you who are familiar with performing risk assessments for non-radioactive chemicals will notice some similarities in the methodologies, but we'll also point out some differences. Now, if you go with me to slide 11. Regulations have been developed over time in response to emerging needs and varying waste streams containing various categories of radioactive materials. The major categories of materials are source materials, that's like uranium and thorium and their combinations, special nuclear material, for example, plutonium, uranium-233 or 235 isotopes, byproduct materials, that is any radioactive material except special nuclear material, and mill tailings. There's also a category called naturally occurring radioactive material, known by the acronym NORM, N-O-R-M, and naturally occurring or accelerator produced radioactive material, known by the acronym NARM, NARM. The source material, special nuclear material, and byproduct material are given special status under the Atomic Energy Act because they are uniquely associated with atomic energy production. Various federal and state statutes have provisions that affect remediation of radionuclides. These include CERCLA, RCRA, UMSHCA, and the Atomic Energy Act. Besides EPA, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Department of Energy, and the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board, plus some various state agencies, have responsibilities and enforce regulations that pertain to radionuclides. If you move to slide 12, different regulatory authorities lead to different regulatory standards, which in turn can lead to different methodologies for calculating cleanup goals. Differences between cleanup levels from site to site are due to variation in one or more of these elements in the cleanup level development process. The process begins with determining which regulatory authority applies. Different cleanup authorities may require different risk assessment approaches, and these authorities include CERCLA, NRC decommissioning requirements, DOE orders, state radiation control regulations, and so on. New data and concepts used in radiation risk assessment, such as risk coefficients, updated slope factors, and soil screening levels for radionuclides, have been developed and further refined these approaches. Some of these will be discussed in the next module of this training. If you go to slide 13, this slide and the next slide are a table, and this table isn't a comprehensive list of radiation standards. It shows most radiation standards in the United States. In addition to this list, most states have drinking water standards for radionuclides. And if they are more stringent than federal MCLs, that is maximum contaminant levels, they are potential ARARs. ARARs are the applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements. You can see that most existing standards are expressed as annual dose limits. And those have millirems per year as the unit. Others are expressed as activity per volume or mass per volume, or as working levels. Now, in addition to accounting for any of these standards that might apply, CERCLA site decision makers must also consider risk. Now, if you go to slide 15. This talks about several aspects of radiation risk assessment. First of all, ionizing radiation is a carcinogen that is cancer-causing. It's a mutagen. It may cause cell mutations, and a teratogen, that is, it may cause fetal malformations. Of these three, cancer risks are usually limiting. That is, they are a greater health risk. So most assessments of harmful effects only consider carcinogenic effects. All the radionuclides are considered group A carcinogens, and the probability of getting cancer is assumed to increase with increasing radiation dose. Now that's important because adverse health effects are seen at relatively high levels of radiation, but not at much lower levels when most cleanup decisions are made. The assumption, though, is that there is a direct correlation between radiation dose and the level of risk, even at very low levels of radiation. Uranium is the exception to the second bullet. In soluble form, uranium is a kidney toxin at mass concentrations slightly above background levels. It is the only radionuclide for which the chemical toxicity has been identified to be comparable to or greater than the radiotoxicity. So a reference dose has been established to evaluate its chemical toxicity. For radioisotopes of uranium, both effects, that is the radiogenic cancer risk and the chemical toxicity, should be considered. Radiation risk assessments include most of the same exposures that are assessed for exposure to chemicals. That's, for example, soil ingestion, fugitive dust inhalation, and drinking water. Now, risk assessments for radiation also include exposure to external gamma radiation, to radon, and to consumption of produce like fruit, vegetables, milk, and beef that may have been grown at the site. Radiation risk assessments do not assess thermal exposure. Now, number four is the total incremental lifetime cancer risk attributed to radiation exposure is estimated as the sum of all the risk from all radionuclides in all exposure pathways. Excess cancer risk from both radionuclides and chemical carcinogens should be summed in order to estimate the combined risk presented by all carcinogenic contaminants. Now, slide 16. In 2002, the radionuclides team of the ITRC published a document titled Determining Cleanup Levels at Radioactively Contaminated Sites. It summarizes the various regulatory standards and requirements that dictate cleanup at radioactively contaminated sites, and it also presents case studies from 12 selected sites to demonstrate variations in how cleanup levels were set. Instructions for getting to a PDF copy of this document are in the notes below this slide if you have a printed copy. And if anyone wants a hard copy sent to them, you can just contact one of today's instructors. By compiling this document, we were hoping site managers and state regulators would take advantage of experiences and lessons learned at similarly contaminated sites. Decision makers may find it useful to examine the basis of cleanup level development at these other sites. The purpose of this report is to examine the context in which radiological cleanup levels have been developed at various sites and to identify common themes and lessons that would improve future decision making. We felt that a common understanding among states, stakeholders, sites, and agencies of how various cleanup levels have been derived will make this process more efficient and defensible and consistent. And consistency in developing remediation goals will help in selecting appropriate environmental characterization and remediation technologies. The next slide, 17. Shows the 12 sites that were selected to demonstrate variations in decision-making frameworks. And these slides are the Brookhaven National Lab in Long Island, New York, the Eniwetok Atoll in the Marshall Islands in the Western Pacific, the Fernald Project in southwestern Ohio, Fort Dixon, New Jersey, the Hanford site in southeastern Washington, Johnston Atoll in the Pacific, the Lindy site in upstate New York, Rocky Flats near Denver.
I got sound.
The Nevada test site, the Oak Ridge Reservation in Tennessee, Weldon Spring site near St. Charles, Missouri, and the Savannah River site in South Carolina. Now, these sites aren't a comprehensive list, but they represent the variety in the nuclear weapons complex, nuclear research, nuclear materials processing, weapons assembly, weapons testing, and accidents. The sites are currently in various stages of remediation. And the next slide, 18, shows a picture of one of these sites. This is a view of Rocky Flats looking northwest with the Front Range in the near background and the Indian Peaks Wilderness in the far background. Now, this is one of DOE's large closure sites and is scheduled to close by the end of 2006. The site actually closed early toward the end of 2005. And all the buildings in this picture, which is about 7 years old, have been taken down now, about 800 or so structures. And that includes building 771, which was once described as the most contaminated building in the country. Many environmental restoration projects were also completed. For example, you can see there's a white L-shaped tent toward the right of the middle in the picture. Covers the remediation of a trench filled with barrels of uranium shavings. And to the left of that is a gray square. That's the infamous 903 pad, which is the source of wind-scattered plutonium at the site. Now, if you move to slide 19, the differences in cleanup levels are due to differences in the following list. First of all, regulatory authority. Differences in radiation standards. And those standards may be applied either directly or as ARARs. And there may be differences in health assessment approaches. Differences in designated land uses, or, and that leads to which exposure scenarios may be selected. Different computer codes may have been used, and the input parameters that were selected may be different. The physical settings of these sites vary, and the state and community acceptance differs from site to site. The state and community acceptance is one of the CERCLA modifying criteria, and we found that local values and politics may have a great influence on the final values selected. And lastly, the type of cleanup goals reported. And we'll explain that further on the next slide, slide 20. This is a list of types of cleanup goals that are reported. Preliminary remediation goals, risk-based concentrations, derived concentration guideline levels, allowable soil or residual soil concentrations, and so forth. Now, these are actual terms used at various sites in the case studies. And you can see that cleanup numbers may come in many varieties. It's important to understand the context and intended use of the values. Otherwise, it's like comparing apples and oranges. Now, on the next slide, 21, there are some sites that have developed both risk-based and dose-based cleanup numbers, such as the example from the ITRC cleanup levels document shown here in this slide. Oak Ridge used both approaches to calculate soil concentrations for the Melton Valley Record of Decision, using input parameters for each that were as equivalent as possible. The more conservative resulting value from either the dose or risk-based calculations was then applied as a cleanup level for each radionuclide. And you can see in the middle there what was termed an alternative concentration, which was based on an ARAR, was used for radium-226. Now, it's interesting that neither approach seems to lead consistently to a more conservative value than the other. The cleanup levels document also shows that similarly at Rocky Flats, the dose calculations done in 1996 were compared to the existing risk-based PRGs to decide which should apply as action levels. And then when the action levels were recalculated at Rocky Flats in 2002, dose-based concentrations were again compared with risk-based concentrations. Slide 22.
Carl, this is Juliana. I'm having a bit of problem with you fading in and out. If you could speak up a little, that might help.
Okay, glad to.
Thank you.
In slide 22, selecting appropriate current and future land use and exposure scenarios is a critical step in calculating cleanup levels. Scenarios are descriptions of various lifestyles and activity patterns that approximate an individual's exposure to contaminants in environmental media. Generally, cleanup that is based on a residential scenario, like a suburban resident, a rural resident, a resident farmer or rancher, those scenarios will allow unrestricted use of a site. Choosing a less conservative scenario may invoke institutional controls and inherent long-term stewardship issues. The considerable difference in half-lives among various radionuclides is an important consideration in deciding whether long-term controls are feasible and therefore may affect the selection of exposure scenarios. Slide 23. Now, all of the cleanup levels shown in this table, which is table 27 out of the ITRC document, all of them are for plutonium, as an example. This table demonstrates that the risk assessment approach used at these various sites influences the amount of risk attributed to the various exposure pathways. The inhalation pathway, for instance, is the major pathway in one case, but it's second or third in the others. The plant ingestion pathway is minor in most cases, but it contributes most to the risk at Hanford, where the resident receptor was considered to eat relatively large amounts of homegrown fruits and vegetables. Now if you go to slide 24, this slide lists the soil concentrations calculated for plutonium at several different sites. As we said before, we can't directly compare these values without knowing the context for deriving them and applying them. This table shows which exposure scenarios were assessed by various sites and demonstrates how cleanup levels at the same site vary depending on land use assumptions. A comparison of cleanup levels for residential versus commercial industrial scenarios at sites where both were calculated shows that a residential scenario yields a cleanup level that's about 3 to 7 times more conservative. Let me quickly talk about the sites listed in this table. First of all, in Weetok, this is a nuclear weapons testing site in the Marshall Islands in the Western Pacific, where weapons were tested from 1946 through 1958. And most of the information that we have came from a Defense Nuclear Agency report in 1981. And that report describes 4 exposure scenarios that represent what were considered various island uses. This report documents an 8-year cleanup effort that began in 1972 and involved 1,000 workers. And the cost here of this cleanup was $100 million, plus the lives of 8 servicemen. In May of 2000, the Islanders were awarded $341 million in a settlement that went in part to complete the cleanup. The Irwin, Tennessee cleanup is of a nuclear fuel services facility. It was cleaned up using NRC decommissioning criteria. So they used a 25 millirem per year dose limit, and it was calculated using the ResRad computer code. Now, at Fernald, the risk numbers here were calculated by DOE and US EPA and Ohio EPA, and they represent a 10 to the minus 6th risk to on-site receptors and a 10 to the minus 5th risk to off-site receptors. So both numbers are within the circular risk range. DOE closure, this is a DOE closure site as well that recently completed its cleanup, and much of that cleanup involved shipping trainloads of Ohio soil off to Utah. And we'll have photos of this here in just a little bit. At Fort Dix, the cleanup involved, or was the result of the 1960 missile accident. This is a Bomark missile, which is a nuclear-tipped anti-aircraft missile. Fort Dix is a U.S. Army base. This is at a Air Force site on that base. In 1992, the Department of Energy Record of Decision established an 8 picocurie per gram cleanup level for plutonium. That's equivalent to about 4 millirems per year. Now, after that, New Jersey promulgated its soil remediation standards for radioactive materials in the year 2000. And the level in those standards is 25 picocuries per gram for plutonium, or about 15 millirems per year. The remedy of this site was a year-long project to remove contaminated soil and again ship trainloads of, in this case, New Jersey soil out to Utah for disposal. At Hanford, these numbers were calculated by the Washington Department of Health, and they are based on a dose limit, 15 millirems per year. They were calculated back in 1995 using the ResRad computer code. And they're not final cleanup numbers, but were preliminary numbers. The final remedy for rad-contaminated soils and groundwater hasn't yet been selected. We'll have a photo of Hanford here in a minute as well. At the Johnson Atoll, this is the site of an accidental, more than one accidental explosion during nuclear testing. This atoll is about 800 miles southwest of Hawaii. in the 13.5 picocurie per gram number that you see in the table was established as an ELARA cleanup level. That's as low as reasonably achievable cleanup level by EPA Region 9. It's equivalent approximately to 7 × 10⁻⁶ residential risk. These 2000 values shown here are recommended in a Defense Threat Reduction Agency report, which again used ResRad to calculate values equivalent to the circular risk range. Now the next several slides show some pictures from these sites. Slide 25 is a picture of the Waste Pit 5 excavation at Fernald. Some pretty yucky looking goo there in this waste pit at Fernald that has now been cleaned up. The next picture is again at Fernald. This is the taken on the on-site disposal facility with the rest of the site in the background. The next slide, 27, is of Hanford in the D reactor area. And you can see down to the lower right-hand corner, the Columbia River, which borders the site. And on slide 28, a picture of the Thor missile, which exploded on the pad and scattered plutonium around Johnson at the atoll at Johnson Island. This is a picture of it before it was erected and exploded. Now, slide 29 lists some more sites. First of all, the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. This is for the Big Trees Park, which is an off-site park adjacent to the Lawrence Livermore Lab. EPA Region 9 established soil screening levels back in 1998. Now, these weren't cleanup levels, but soil screening levels. At Rocky Flats, these numbers were established by joint working groups consisting of the Department of Energy, EPA, and the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. And this seemed like a nearly constant project at Rocky Flats, establishing then reestablishing cleanup levels. And for years, I was part of these working groups. And starting back in 1996, when actual levels based on 15 milligram annual dose limits were established. Now, that 15 milligram annual dose limit was used back then. It was in a draft part in draft part 196. And it seemed to be the up-and-coming applicable requirement, so it was used back then, but it was then later withdrawn. At the time, as compared, those numbers based on 15 millirems were compared to the existing risk-based TRGs to decide which should apply as action levels. And the ResRad computer code was used to calculate those. And then in the year 2000, the risk-based PRGs, 10⁻⁶ risk-based PRGs, were recalculated. There were new slope factors and other factors that led us to recalculate those PRGs. A couple years later, in 2002, the refuge worker and resident action levels were derived from probabilistic risk calculations. This was at a 10⁻⁵ risk level using the 95th percentile of the risk distribution. So the wildlife refuge worker action level for plutonium, the 50 picocuries per gram that you see listed there, is actually a negotiated level. It's well below the calculated level. The office worker and open space user action levels correspond to point estimates of the 10⁻⁵ risk for those two scenarios. These risk-based action levels were compared to and found to be more conservative than ResRad calculated 25 millirem per year levels. And those dose-based concentrations were derived to satisfy the state's decommissioning criteria, which were deemed to be relevant and appropriate requirements. And so that's why we did both dose-based and risk-based. Now again, the result here was the truckloads of Colorado soil were shipped off to Utah, as well as New Mexico, Nevada, and other places. And I'll show some photos of this site in a minute. The Tonopah test range. These numbers were calculated by the Department of Energy, and they represent initial cleanup levels for the double tracks and clean slate sites. These are based on conservative literature-based values for several different receptors. And these are forward calculations of doses to the various receptors, verifying that all annual doses would be below the 100 milligram per year public dose limit. Now, the conclusion from these case studies in the TRC case studies document is that these calculated plutonium values cannot be directly compared without knowing the context for each. Some are dose-based, some are risk-based. They're calculated for different risk or dose levels, and they're protective of different exposure scenarios. Now the next few slides are of Rocky Flats. Here's the aerial view again in slide 30, and the next couple slides show some remediation. Slide 31 is the remediation of the 903 pad where oils and solvents contaminated with plutonium and uranium were stored on a pad and leaked a large percentage of their contents into the soil, and later winds distributed that quite a distance from the pad. The next slide, 32, is of some of the building decontamination and decommissioning. And seeing this reminds me that the ITRC RADS team is currently working on completing a document about building decontamination and decommissioning, and concurrently working on a new training that will describe this process. Now, if you go to slide 33, there are several conclusions that we drew from the observations made in the ITRC document, and some of them are shown on these slides. If you go to 34, here's some more of the conclusions. Let me just read a couple of them that led to today's training. First of all, consistency within given risk assessment approaches is a worthwhile and achievable goal. And one of our modules today will talk about a tool that will help us to achieve this consistency. And one of our conclusions also was training would help lend consistency to assessment of risk and selection of remedies during cleanup. Again, this directly led to today's training. The overall conclusion from the cleanup levels document is the determination of cleanup levels can involve complex and emotional issues. There's actual costs, social costs, net benefit to stakeholders, land values, environmental detriments, and so forth. At each site, special circumstances exist, and each cleanup action should be evaluated on its own merits. Now that concludes Module 1. In the next module, Dr. Smita Siddhanti will present human health assessment approaches for radionuclides. Smita?
Yeah, hi, everybody. This is Smita Siddhanti, and in this module, we'll shift gears from application of risk assessment at contaminated sites to the details of the methodology of these human health risk assessment approaches for radionuclides. Can everybody hear me? Juliana, I'm okay?
Yes, you sound great.
Right. Okay. Wanted to introduce this slide 35 and let you know that, as Carl was just explaining in the last module, repeatedly we heard about dose assessment and risk assessment, and those were the methodologies we heard about. And we heard that the various sites derive different cleanup numbers due to the use of varying risk assessment approaches dictated by varying regulatory authorities. And from that, we needed to get more detail to you in terms of explaining the three things that are the goals of this module. The three goals are, the first is to provide you an overview of these radiation risk assessment approaches, namely the risk approach and the dose approach that we have been talking about. The second is to provide you the basis of these variations, the details of what goes behind the scene in this in these various approaches. Once again, as Carl was pointing out, that we do recognize that the audience have a different latitude of expertise in risk assessment. So for some, it'll be more basic than others, but we're trying to balance this. And then the third goal is to introduce you to the updates of these for both these approaches, what has been done and where we are with it. So with that, the module is divided into these slides of that address these three goals. The first, the slide, the next one, the slide 36, gives you the big picture of what we mean by the risk approach and the dose approach. So precisely, these are the two approaches that have been used in the cleanup of radioactive contamination. The risk-based approach is the cancer slope factor approach that we have heard in the chemical world. The dose-based approach is basically the effective dose equivalent, or the total effective dose equivalent approach that has been used in the DOE and NRC context, while the risk-based approach is more used in the EPA context. The risk-based approach is where risk is calculated directly by using the cancer slope factor and then multiplying it by the total exposure, which includes the internal exposure and the external exposure. Just to reiterate for those that may not have been exposed to this, that in chemical world, the internal exposure or intake of a chemical is the exposure, while an additional pathway in a radionuclide world is the external exposure due to the radiation, alpha, beta, or gamma radiation emitted from the radionuclide. So in terms of the dose-based approach, the dose is calculated by the dose conversion factor versus the cancer slope factor, and that's the major change between these two. But what does that mean? In real terms, the risk approach is where risk is calculated at the likelihood of excess cancer incidence using slope factor, while the dose approach uses the dose conversion factor to measure the population at which the population is exposed, the dose at which they're exposed. So the calculation of dose approach calculates the dose at which the population is exposed, while the risk-based approach calculates the probability of excess cancer risk. So that's where the fundamental difference is. The dose approach converts the level of exposure to a contaminant so that the effective dose absorbed in humans exposed is calculated, while the risk approach converts the exposure to the incidence of increased cancer. And that, as I said, is the fundamental difference. So thus, dose is a measure of levels of radiation exposure and is used to compare with safe levels. Now, while risk is a probability of increased cancer due to exposure of certain level of radiation. I just want to make sure that people catch that early on, that these are two different measures altogether. But also one needs to understand in terms of the radiation world that in the chemical world, the absorbed dose is the dose at which that we are dealing with in terms of exposure. Absorbed dose in a chemical world is actually the chemical's uptake itself in the body, while in terms of radiation, the absorbed dose is the expression of energy imparted per unit mass of the tissue, and it's measured in rad units. The basis of this methodological difference between the two approaches comes from the basis of regulatory authority and the agencies that implemented these regulatory authorities. And so as we discussed, the EPA used the risk-based approach, and NRC and DOE have traditionally used the ICRP, which is the International Commission of Radiological Protection, their effective dose equivalent approach. And the reason the dose approach originated was because the DOE was dealing with, and NRC were dealing with nuclear operations, and doses can be would be measured easily on the site. And so the ICRP methods are based on safe dose, below which exposures are protective. EPA approaches the cleanup from a perspective of having studied cancer-causing chemicals. But they were used to expressing future risks in terms of excess cancer-causing probabilities. And that's the reason why these two originated in a different way. But in reality, over time, of course, we have figured out the way to convert the dose calculated by the dose approach into a risk probability. And that conversion happens by multiplying the dose with the probability coefficient to arrive at a risk value. And we'll go a little bit more in depth in later slides. So with that, let's move on to the next slide, which will give more details on how we calculate risk and dose. And moving on to slide 37. I can hear some people laughing. I'm moving on to slide 37. The risk, as you see, is equal to exposure times cancer slow factor, and the dose is exposure times DCF. And if you look at that, the risk is a unitless number, and I mean it is unitless, and the risk is basically the potentially exposed human receptor. It's computed as the product of the estimated lifetime intake of external or internal exposure for a contaminant times the measure of the likelihood of incremental cancer induction per unit of exposure for that contaminant. So the cancer slow factor, as we see here, is a measure of the likelihood of incremental cancer induction per unit of exposure, while the dose conversion factor is the dose per unit of exposure. So those are the differences in calculating the dose versus the risk. So the risk is, as I said, is what we use in the risk approach, and the dose is what we use in the dose approach. The slow factor is an estimate of the probability of response. That is the probability of an individual developing cancer per unit intake. Here, the cancer slow factors have been taken, the intake, and used a set of assumptions to calculate the absorbed dose. And so we'll go more into how we calculate the slow factors later. But the dose is compared to human exposure, cancer data, and the risk of cancer is assigned. And that's what happens in the risk calculation. The radionuclide cancer slow factors are the best estimates of age averaged lifetime excess total cancer risk per unit of intake of a rad or per unit external exposure of radiation. EPA has slow factors for most of the radionuclides and have published it, and they have also for different routes of exposure. For example, there's inhalation slow factors and ingestion slow factors for each radionuclide. The dose assessment approach, on the other hand, is where the dose is calculated by multiplying dose conversion factor for a given rad by total intake or exposure to that radionuclide. And this can be ingestion, inhalation, or external exposure, any of those pathways. The calculated dose can be multiplied by probability coefficient to arrive at a risk value, which we said we'll talk about later as well. Both the dose approaches are based on, the dose approach, by the way, is based on the annual exposure to radiation. So the dose here refers to effective dose equivalent, the total effective dose equivalent, which is TEDE. And TED is a measure of both external EDE and internal EDE. So the external exposure and internal exposure are both included in this, in the dose calculation. Given that background, let's move on to the next slide, 38. that goes more into, it tells you that the risk is, if you take an example of inhalation pathway, you can see that risk is calculated by inhalation slope factor times the following units. As you see, the variables, they all together make up for the exposure variable. So exposure is similar in both equations. As you see, the three things going into it are the RAD, concentration in air, times breathing rate, times exposure duration. If you take those three, they're both common to both the equations. The only thing that differs is the slope factor and the DCF in each of those two different equations, as you see. And that's how the inhalation pathway example would tell you how calculations differ. DCFs are, as I said, they're contaminant-specific, while slope factors are contaminant and pathway-specific. So for slope factors, we do have slopes for, like, plutonium, and they will have their separate pathways in terms of inhalation and ingestion, while DCFs don't have a pathway-specific DCF. The next slide, 39, gives you more the basis of risk and dose approaches. And as I was explaining earlier, that these two methods depend on a particular radionuclide and exposure pathways for site-specific conditions. And these differences may be attributed to factors such as consideration of competing mortality risk, age-dependent rates assigned to individual organ risks, and differences in dosimetric and toxicological assumptions. So a number of factors go into the variation within the slope factor approach and the DCF approach to make them more detailed in terms of their specific variations. The comparison between the basis of these two methods are summarized in the table that's given in this slide and the next two slides. And these tables, by the way, come out of our document that Carl was referring to. It's the document titled Determining Cleanup Goals at Radioactively Contaminated Sites, the case studies. And it's the one that ITRC's radionuclides team has published 2 years back. And this, as we see here, the standards vary for both. If you see that in the first point, for instance, the risk and dose approaches vary in the way they calculate the reasonable maximum exposure, the lifetime exposure to an individual that is used in the risk assessment approach or risk-based approach, the unit that they use is the RME, the reasonable maximum exposure that we all have seen in the chemical world. The dose approach, whereas, uses annual exposure to an average member of the critical group. So the difference here is that the RME is a different unit, and it's the highest exposure that is reasonably expected to occur at a site. And in terms of the average member of critical group, which is the dose approach, there they use the annual exposure to the group of individuals expected to receive the greatest exposure to residual radioactivity for any applicable set of circumstances. So right here, with just the first point, you can see the slight variation in what is being measured as exposure and the unit of exposure. And similarly, if you go on in the rest of the slide, you would see that the variation on a broader scale is the risk is unitless, and dose equivalent measures are in units of rem, millirem, or sievert. And the standards vary in terms of what we are comparing. The risk is 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 6 range, whereas the dose equivalent is millirem per year. And the slope factor, again, is based on the U.S. population, while the DCFs are based on population from other nations. So given that level of variation, we also can see on the next slide, slide 40, the series of variation continue here at a different level. Here we go more into the derivation of flow factors and derivation of DCF and what were the underlying models used, risk models used, or data used to come up with that. In a broad picture, when you look at that, the points here give you how risk. The first point relates to the risk model used for flow factor, deriving flow factor and DCF. For flow factor, the age-dependent and sex-dependent risk models are used for various cancer sites. And for DCF, we do not have sex-dependent models, so there's no male-female thing. It's only age-dependent, infant, children, and adults. So similarly, if you go more into the genetic risk is used in flow factor, does not consider genetic risk. The DCF considers the risk to genes, the genetic risk, and the modification of the genetic makeup and the impact of radiation on that. So similar kind of things continue in the detailed variation. If you look more carefully, you would see that the last point deals with the low LET and high LET estimates, and LET is the linear energy transfer. So in layman's terms, the low LET is what we know as gamma radiation, and the high LET is more the alpha and beta radiation. And the chemicals that radionuclides that relate to gamma are radium-226 and cesium-137, cobalt-60. These are the ones that we are familiar with, while alpha and beta radiation come out of. Alpha is more americium, plutonium-236, and beta is strontium-90, iodine-131. The reason I bring that up is that those estimates from low LET are different from, and high LET are considered separately for each target organ for the slow factor derivation. While in the dose equivalent approach, they both the low LET and high LET are used, but they are converted and appropriately multiplied by certain factors. So they do make a difference in the way the number is derived or the basis of that number. So with that, let's move on to the next slide, 41. And this gives one more layer of variation in the dosimetry and toxicological assumptions in deriving slow factors versus DCFs. And you would see, like, under the risk, the RBE, which has been used relative biological effectiveness for alpha radiation, is used in both approaches, but the application differs, as we see in the first point. You would see that under risk, the RBE is associated with the organ and the disease, while in the dose approach, the RBE is associated with only the organ, so less concerned with the disease. It's the similar, the definition of lung dose. Proportions vary in assumptions here, and the period on which the whole effect is integrated varies in both slow factor and DCF. The slow factor, for instance, takes into account variable length, and it does not exceed 110 years. So different age-specific models use risk models differently. While in dose approach, the fixed length is 50 years for dose assessment. But what does it all mean? One can get really lost in the forest from the trees. So what does it all mean for a risk assessment purpose? And let's see that in next slide, 42. What this means really is that couple of points to take away from all these details in the last few slides. The first point to remember is that the dose and risk are closely related and are somewhat interconvertible. So that's a good news for all of us in risk assessment world. The second thing is that in general, most radiation standards are concerned with radiological dose. We do not calculate the risk associated with a given dose. One simply compares the dose to an appropriate dose-based standard. For example, 100 milligrams per year for public exposure or 5,000 milligrams per year for occupational exposure. However, the risks associated with a given dose can be calculated using a probability coefficient, as I said, which from various methodologies, they have ICRP has calculated this number or risk coefficient as 7.3 times 10 to the minus 2 per sievert. For every sievert is equivalent to 100,000 milligrams. Now, this risk coefficient is based on the gamma radiation, low LET gamma radiation, so clearly it's not appropriate for some radionuclide. And it does consider all cancers. So we can then use this risk coefficient to multiply those with the probability of risk coefficient and come up with the risk value. So in somewhat, we can convert the what we get from the dose approach to what we want to get from the risk approach. So in that sense, they're interconvertible, but it is important to remember that the converted values may be somewhat different than directly calculated values. So if one calculates a risk number from using a cancer flow factor approach, would come up sometimes with a very different number in terms of magnitude of risk than what you would do by using a dose approach and then using the risk coefficient multiplier and come up with a risk value there. That might be very different. And the reason being, as we mentioned before, that the basis of the risk coefficient is the low LET gamma radiation. And if that's the case, then sometimes in other pathways with alpha and beta emitters, this does not apply one-to-one directly. And so for EPA's purposes, EPA believes that dose calculation using TCFs may be applicable in limited circumstances for low LET gamma radiating radionuclides. But for CERCLA cleanup, TCFs are not adequate for assessing risks, especially from internal exposure to alpha and beta emitting radionuclides. So that's just something to really keep in mind, given that quite a few of these, most of the DOE sites have to be cleaning up under CERCLA, so they need to be aware of this fact. Moving on to the next slide, 43. This provides details of terminology used in dose equivalent approach. So if we get little more understanding of what we were talking about in the absorbed dose concept that we mentioned earlier. Repeating myself, but the absorbed dose in a chemical is the uptake of chemical itself, while in the RAD world, the absorbed dose is the energy imparted per unit mass of tissue. So that's what we are measuring here. It's not what people are exposed to, but what the tissue actually absorbs. So the absorbed dose is an expression of energy imparted per unit mass of tissue, which is measured in RAD. Dose equivalent is a measure of energy absorbed by living tissue, adjusted by the quality factor of different types of radiation. And that's measured in sievert and REM. The next step of that, if you take ahead of that, is the effective dose equivalent, and which is the dose equivalent adjusted by an organ weighing factor, to provide risk-based equivalence to external radiation dose. So EDE measures the external radiation dose, while the CEDE, which is the following bullet on the slide, gives you the committed dose internally to various organs. So the sum of the CEDE, which is the internal radiation measure, and the EDE to external radiation measure of the dose. The sum of that is the total effective dose equivalent. So in dose approach, what we call dose that we are calculating is the sum of the external and internal dose that we are measuring. The next slide, 44, shows you the updates to the dose equivalent approach that we just talked about. The most of the standards here, DCFs are based on ICRP. And the publication that ICRP is, that most of them are in 1979. The more updated version is 1996. That's the publication 72. And the revised DCFs were given in the publication 72. That is the ICRP 1996. And they are just getting used in certain sites, and they are based more on the scientific data that's more advanced, and they're more applicable to general public in relation to the earlier DCFs that were more based or applicable to occupational exposures. The next slide, 45, shows you the Superfund's radiation risk assessment approaches and their timeline of chronology, basically, of radiation risk assessment developed in EPA guidelines. And if you look at that, you would notice that the first time that EPA ever related to a risk assessment methodology for radionuclides was in 1989 RAGS Part A, which was updated in Part B, which is the radiation, you know, risk assessment, not radiation, but yeah, risk assessment guidance. And the Part B related to the PRG calculations. PRG are the preliminary remediation goals. And we will talk a little bit more about that in the modules to come. But the PRG calculation then was advanced. The methodology was advanced in 2000 by the soil screening guidance for radionuclides. And by the way, all this is available on EPA's website. And the following to that was 2001 supplemental guidance for the soil screening levels. And the latest development is in the PRG calculator that EPA has come up with. And just to clarify that the PRG calculator and the soil screening guidance are relating to similar terminology, just that we are referring back to as PRG calculator. But they also are similar to what we would do for calculating soil screening levels. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the next slide and as well as in the next module. And as I said, the building calculator is, well, I didn't tell you that, but there's a building calculator that also is getting developed and is developed now. So that's another advancement to PRG calculator and EPA. So as I said, all this is available on EPA website. The next slide is 46, where we have some updates on the slow factor approach. Specifically, the new flow factors for radionuclides were published in 2001 in the HEAST that tables that EPA publishes, and they were based on the improved radiation risk coefficients in Federal Guidance Report Number 13, which was published in 99, and ICRP Publication 72 that we just talked about. And these updated risk coefficients are based on the developments in radiation risk and dosimetry. And they're basically based on more recent epidemiological evidence for cancer risk, updated vital statistics. They're also based on improved biokinetic and dosimetric models. And as I said earlier, that they're more relevant to general public and they're more recent external dosimetry. And they can be found on EPA website as well. The next slide, 47, gives more updates and details of more updates of slow factor approach. And here, as we mentioned, that the new EPA 2001 published the new slow factor. They, again, are based on these cancer risk models updated and the dosimetry models, and the specific models are given on the slide as you see them, and same with the dosimetry models and exposure pathways. The exposure pathway, by the way, that was expanded is the ingestion pathway was added, tap water, food, milk, and iodine, radioiodine uptake was added to that. And they were more relating to the average number of general public. And as I said, they can be found on EPA website. The next slide, number 48, goes to show you the soil screening guidance, and the supplemental guidance, as I said, is the update to the soil screening guidance. And supplemental guidance came out in 2001. It's a peer-reviewed draft still, and it's publicly available. It's still not finalized. The methods that were added to the SSL guidance are shown here on the slide itself. The same new SSL equations are used to calculate PRGs in the newly developed PRG calculator, which we will elaborate in Module 3 of this training. The SSLs and PRGs, by the way, let's talk a minute about that. They're both risk-based concentrations, and they're both back calculated from target risk of 10 to the minus 6. The difference in PRG and SSL is the PRG are medium-specific values. They're media-specific. They incorporate all exposure pathways. And PRGs are based on combined risk from multiple pathways from exposure to a single medium. So, for instance, residential water, industrial soil, these medium can be multiple pathways for the same media. And that's what PRGs are, while SSLs are derived from specific pathways. That is, they are pathway specific. They're ingestion SSLs, inhalation SSLs, but not media specific. So that's sort of the difference. EPA continues to update PRG calculator consistent with the new policies and science. And we'll hear more about that in following modules. The next slide gives as the picture of, it shows the development between agencies to bridge the gap of variation between the risk assessment methods we just talked about. So the MOU that was developed between EPA and NRC in 2002 is a great step in the right direction. NRC, as we said, is the proponent of dose-based standard, and EPA is proponent of risk-based standard, and they both came up with an MOU that identifies the interaction of the two agencies for application of CERCLA and NRC's approaches to D&D size decommissioning and decontamination NRC license sites. But it's a step in the right direction, and the ITRC believes that implementation of this MOU between the two agencies will ensure that future confusion about dual regulation does not occur regarding the cleanup and reuse of NRC license sites. So that's a good thing. The next slide, which is the last slide in my module here, is this is slide 50, which gives you the selected tools that have been developed for human health assessment of radionuclides. The first two refer to the radionuclide PRG risk calculator and the ARR dose calculator. Both of these we are going to talk about in module 3, and Stuart Walker will give more details on that. The ResRad computer code, which is also a very prevalent tool that has been used to calculate both dose and risk calculations, is we're not going to elaborate on that here, but it is a tool that's been a lot of details are given about that on the website that is shown on the slide here. EPA's Superfund policy, however, recommends using the PRG risk and ARR dose calculator in place of ResRad, even though ResRad has been widely used by DOE, NRC, EPA, and DOD. So with this, I'm going to move on to the first Q&A part of this training for the next 10 minutes, after which Stuart Walker will elaborate on these risk assessment tools in Module 3. Thank you.
Thank you, Smita. We are now on slide 51. And we do want to take a break now to get questions from our audience. If you're in our phone line audience, you can unmute your phone. And if you've used our system, that is *7 to unmute and ask questions. In our simulcast audience, usually you're able to select that orange question mark button. But if you do have trouble with that today, you can send in a question using your email. And you would send that to training@itrcweb.org. That's training@itrcweb.org. orange.org if you're unable to get that orange question mark button to work. I'd like to start with a question from our phone line audience. When you ask your question, if you'd state your name and location. Would someone in our phone line audience like to start?
Juliana, this is Stuart. I just want to make sure that you know I'm on.
Thank you so much. We're glad to hear you're on.
Okay, but I'm since Slide 5.
I had a question. My name is Shaylee Rahman. I'm calling in from New York.
Yes.
And I just wanted to clarify something. I have a bit of confusion about something on slide, something that was said around slide 38 and maybe just a little before slide 38, and it was about DCFs and DCFs not being pathway specific. And I was wondering, I just was wondering if someone could clarify on that. Do you mean not specific to inhalation versus ingestion, or not specific to soil ingestion versus food ingestion?
No, this is Smita.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is ingestion versus inhalation.
So, okay, so that's what I'm confused about, because I thought that FGR 12 and FGR 11, for example, had inhalation-specific DCFs for the radionuclides versus ingestion-specific DCFs for the radionuclides, as well as ICRP 72.
Right. Unlike flow factors, which are both, I mean, you're saying in terms of really media and pathway-specific versus flow factors that are more media and pathway-specific. That DCFs, you're saying DCFs have had both inhalation DCFs and ingestion DCFs, but not soil versus soil ingestion versus. Is that what you just said?
Well, what I'm trying to understand is, I think I heard you say that you said that DCFs are not pathway specific, and that in certain cases you use. You shouldn't use DCFs because they're not pathway specific, and I understood you to mean external versus internal exposure when you were talking about it not being pathway specific. And I'm wondering whether I mishear that, or were you meaning something else?
What I was trying to say. Is, and I don't know what I've exactly conveyed it, that they both have, and Stuart, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that they both, the cancer, the slow factors are both pathway-specific and immediate, I mean, they're contaminant-specific and pathway-specific. While DCFs are contaminant-specific, but they are all not available for pathway-specific.
No, they're also pathway specific.
Right. That's what I was. I just wanted to clarify. That's what I thought.
Then I stand corrected.
Okay. So in that specific, I'm sorry. I just wasn't sure whether you were meaning media specific versus the difference between internal and external the exposure.
I guess the internal and external exposure is what.
Seems
to be the more accurate answer for this, right? Because they are available for other pathways and media. Is that what I may have to check on this, what I've just said that, but Stuart, add on to it if you have any new information.
Yeah, currently, I mean, there are probably a few more dose conversion factors for different pathways than there are slope factors, although we're trying to kind of even that up. I mean, where there's so those convergent factors, say, for external exposure at different depths, we have in one of the new tools that Carl alluded to with our training next year for decommissioning, we have added in ground plane. And so hopefully that will go in a building calculator. Hopefully that will go final in the next few weeks. And then we're looking at adding in slope factors at different depths. Like you said, I'm not in front of a computer right now, so I can't, or my actual in my office. But I think I remember though that ingestion is not broken up by food or soil for the dose conversion factors, if I remember correctly, but
I think it's just ingestion.
That's what I remember.
I think it's just ingestion.
Whereas for slope factors, it is broken out.
Right. That's I think what was being alluded in terms of having that right now. But things are getting developed since the time we did lots of training. So yeah.
This is Linda Henry from California.
Yes.
Early in the presentation, I believe I heard someone say that the risk for radionuclides is all associated with gamma radiation. And being somewhat naive on this subject, being a chemical risk assessor, what about the particles themselves, like the alpha or beta particles? Is that all part of the dose conversion factors and slope factors?
I don't think we ever mentioned that this was only related to risk, but related just to alpha, to gamma radiation. I think we talked about alpha and beta emitters.
Okay, then I misunderstood. My apologies.
Yeah, no, certainly.
Yeah, they're factored into the slope factors and the dose conversion factors.
I had another question along the similar line. This is Shaley again from New York, and I have a note here that I think this is when you were talking about dose and risk being very closely related.
Yeah.
And saying that one was based on LET. Was that risk was based on LET and that the dose approach was not? I think
That goes back to the table, Samantha.
I think I heard that. I have a note here for slide 42.
Looking for the slide 42.
I think it's slide 40.
Okay.
And the you're talking about in the table.
Yeah, there is
the last row in the table on slide 40.
Results of a dose to a risk.
Okay.
And if the risk coefficient itself is based on the gamma radiation, so low LET, and that's why sometimes that's not very applicable in every circumstance.
So the risk coefficient is based on LET?
Yes, on gamma.
Okay.
Right. And that was the exact qualifier there.
Yeah, in some of our internal analysis where we looked at different isotopes and different land uses, to see what the linkage is between doing the dose assessment and risk assessment, how readily they translate over. I mean, this changes every time you change either the slope factor or the dose conversion factor, but it can vary by or an order of magnitude more than what you think the risk is from a given dose in either direction. So it's not quite as exact if you're trying to get to a risk number.
Right, and I think probably the previous question that the person asked related to the same issue. And you said you heard risk is only related to gamma and not to alpha and beta. And we were referring more to the risk coefficient that's used in the conversion from dose assessment result to the risk result. I just wanted to clarify that the previous speaker, if she caught what we were talking about, or the previous question.
I do have a question from our simulcast audience that came in before that problem. Lisa Ledwidge at IEER in Minneapolis. One of the early slides stated that cancer risks are usually the most harmful. Is there a standard way to account for non-cancer effects, as for instances in the case of tritium, which I understand can cause the placenta and cause miscarriage and or birth defects?
Well, for the levels that we're cleaning up to, the only radionuclide we really look at the non-cancer effects are for total uranium, where it's soluble, and there we look at the hazard index and account for kidney toxicity. The question is getting at a higher, more acute type of effects, which, as far as But this course is not really covering those. This is dealing more with kind of like remedial cleanup levels, if you're talking from a circlet standpoint. If Carl or Samantha want to add to that.
No, that's true. We're dealing with very low levels at which most cleanup levels at most sites are set, and not acute levels.
Yeah, so basically we're saying that we acknowledge that there are other impacts that are non-cancer, the addition to cancer actually, but the cancer is the limiting effect. That's what we are dealing with in terms of cleanup. And we're using that as the levels at which they will cause cancer. Then if we can protect for that, then we can protect for the other.
With the one exception that we noted for total uranium.
For uranium, right.
Another simulcast question, this from Ram Roman at EPA Region 3. Do we know European Union risk assessment procedures? Can you compare their standards to ours?
The European Union has a directive out where they do use, it's in different units. I mean, they use sieverts and millisieverts, but it's essentially the 25 millirem standard, using the ICRP 60-72 dose conversion factors, at least within the European Union. And the dose compliance calculator that I'm going to talk about in the next module, at the end of the module, in the user guide, if I remember correctly, we referenced back to the European Union directive where they came out with that guidance towards their member states.
Thank you.
I don't really have much information on how all their modeling practices. I think that might be country specific. I've seen a couple different guidance documents. Sorry.
Do you have another question from our phone line audience?
Yeah, this is Joe Eibelberg with Region 9. I just had an observation, and I was wondering if you could comment on it. In the initial part of the presentation, there was a cleanup level given for Johnson Atoll for 2.1 picograms per picocuries per gram for plutonium. And later, there was one given for Big Trees Park of 2.5 picocuries per gram. And Big Trees Park is a children's park where children would ingest soil, whereas Johnson Atoll is basically vacant, and you would only have intermittent workers. And so I was wondering why it would make sense to have a lower cleanup level for Johnson Atoll.
Good question. Being from Region 9, I would refer to yourself to answer that question. Both of those were set.
Could you just speculate on what might be some reasons? Because I just found it curious. I actually don't know.
Well, for one thing, park use. One of the factors, one of the sensitive factors in any equation is time spent on site. And, it affects the results directly, of course. And I'm assuming, I don't have it right in front of me, but I'm assuming that the time spent on site at Big Trees Park was limited, for a park user versus someone that was on at Johnson Atoll. The exposure scenarios were a researcher, a resident, a tourist, a homesteader. So those scenarios would.
Carl, that I understand that Johnson Atoll was a very sensitive, became a sensitive site after all the debate that went into it. There was some native population that was either suing U.S. government or whatever for...
Well, not at Johnson Atoll. There were no natives there. That was Eniwetok.
Oh, that was Eniwetok. Sorry. There was some... I thought that might have some...
On Johnson Atoll, the ecological risks are the important thing. So I was wondering in that regard, are there ecological endpoints for these radionucleotides?
This is Stuart. There's guidance that's been put out probably late 80s from DOE. They're called the graded guidelines that are generally used. There are some other eco-risk models out there, like none of which that we have, that EPA is currently recommending or endorsing, but we have often used the graded guidelines guidance at our own sites, and we are developing a risk calculator for eco that's based on the endpoints in the graded guidelines and pretty similar to the equations used in that guidance.
Thank you. For our participants and for our instructors, we do need to wrap up this question and answer break. So if we do have more questions or more follow-up to this question, we can try to address it in the next question and answer break. I'd like to ask everyone in our phone line audience to put your phones back on mute, and if you've used our system, that is *6 to mute your phone. And I'll remind you again at the end for the next question and answer to unmute your phone, it'll be *7. If you turn to slide 52, we're going to turn today's presentation now over to Stuart Walker at the U.S. EPA. Stuart?
Thanks, Juliana. By the end of this third module, the participants of this course should be able to understand the concept and assumptions of PRGs, be able to use PRGs appropriately at their site, learn how to calculate PRGs, and become acquainted with EPA's PRG and ARAR dose calculators for radionuclides. It is important to note that these two calculators are consistent with how EPA assesses risk from chemicals at Superfund sites, except to account for technical differences between radionuclides and chemicals. This enables users to have a harmonized approach that is endorsed by EPA when addressing radiological risk and dose and chemical risk at the same Superfund site. This harmonized approach is consistent with EPA's One Cleanup Program initiative. Okay, let's turn to slide 53. At CERCLA sites, PRGs are concentrations that are either based on ARARs, or if ARARs are not available or sufficiently protective, then PRGs are based on risk. This module focuses on risk-based PRGs, which are derived from standardized equations combining exposure information assumptions with EPA toxicity data. Please note that PRGs are not de facto cleanup standards. Okay, let's move on to slide 54. PRGs are contaminant levels considered by the EPA to be protective for humans, including sensitive subgroups, over a lifetime. PRGs are used early in the site process to help identify areas, contaminants, and conditions that do not require further attention at a particular site. Okay, let's move on to slide 55. So I mentioned before, PRGs are identified early in the CERCLA process. PRGs can be modified as needed at the end of the remedial investigation or during the feasibility study based on site-specific information from the baseline risk assessment. But ultimately, the remediation levels are selected through the use of all 9 of the NCP remedy selection criteria. So let's go to slide 56. The PRG calculator was developed to help risk assessors, site managers, and other stakeholders at CERCLA sites by streamlining risk assessment. It is EPA's intent that this will facilitate the selection of cleanup levels at sites. You can see here the website address for the calculator. Okay, let's move on to slide 57. The risk-based PRGs for radionuclides are based on cancer risk. Non-cancer effects are not considered for radionuclides, except for uranium. Cleanup concentrations are expressed in both units of activity and units of mass. The PRG calculator does not address ecological effects. Okay, let's move on to slide 58. The calculator provides generic risk-based PRG concentrations that are derived using standardized exposure assumptions. It can also be used to create site-specific concentrations by modifying the default exposure assumptions with information you gain site-specifically. In order to develop PRGs for a site, you must be able to answer some fundamental questions about the site. This information includes which radionuclides are present on site, which media are contaminated, which land use are you assuming, and what are the underlying exposure assumptions behind pathways of individual exposure? Okay, let's move on to slide 59. You can now see a picture of how the calculator looks when you go to the web page. In the next 20 slides, we will show you how the calculator works. These slides will be presented in the same order that you would see material in the PRG calculator when you are operating it after clicking on the green PRG search button near the top of the web page. Okay, let's turn into slide 60. You see that step one is to select an exposure scenario. The calculator includes the following seven exposure scenarios for developing PRGs. Residential, which is essentially a suburban residence. Outdoor and indoor industrial commercial workers. Tap water coming into a residence. Someone who eats a lot of fish. A level of residual contamination in soil that will protect groundwater. And agricultural, which is for a resident farm family. You may select any one or all of these exposure scenarios when developing either generic or site-specific PRGs. In step two, you are also given a choice of having your results in either PQ-Curie's program, which are the units usually used in the United States, or in Becquerel's program, which most of the rest of the world uses. Okay, let's move on now to slide 61. In step three, you must select one or more radionuclides you want to develop PRGs for. The calculator provides about 800 radionuclides as choices. You see here that some of the radionuclides in radioactive decay chain products are designated with the suffix plus D to indicate that cancer risk estimates for these radionuclides include the contributions from their short-lived decay products, assuming secular equilibrium. The decay chain for plus D radionuclides ends in 100 years. Step 4 allows for selection of PRGs using either default parameters or site-specific measurements. Step 5 is basically selecting which output mode for you want to show the calculated PRGs. Let's move on to slide 62. If in step 4 you choose to calculate PRGs using site-specific parameters, the first screen you will see when you go in site-specific is the calculation of particulate emission factor, or PEF. The PEF is required for calculating the soil scenarios for residential, agricultural, outdoor, and indoor worker. The default PEF is dependent on the weather conditions in specific cities. Okay, let's move on to slide 63. On this slide, you can glance at the map, which provides the climatic zone conditions for U.S. states and cities. Okay, now let's move on to slide 64. Here are the risk pathways that are used for calculating PRGs for residential exposure scenario. The residential PRG includes the risk from direct ingestion of contaminated soil, the risk from inhaling wind-blown contaminated dust, the risk from external radiation from gamma-emitting radionuclides in soil, and the risk from ingestion of homegrown fruits and vegetables. In the first bullet referring to risk from direct ingestion of contaminated soil, the acronym SFO in the equation refers to the slope factor for soil ingestion. The FF in the other equations refer to the slope factors for inhalation, external exposure, and the ingestion of food. Okay, let's move on to slide 65. We're going to briefly show you how the equation for the residential exposure scenario will actually appear on your screen. The numerator is the unitless target risk that factors in the number of years of exposure and the radionuclide half-life, both for accommodating the fate and decay of radionuclides over time. The denominator is the total risk, calculated for scenarios shown in the last slide and adjusted for exposure duration. The total risk calculations show the input parameters for the four sub-scenarios for residential soil, which are incidental ingestion of soil, inhalation of wind-blown dust, external radiation, and ingestion of homegrown fruits and vegetables. Okay, now we're turning to slide 66. You can see some of the PRG parameters that may be modified when you select the site-specific PRG option. The modifiable parameters include the target risk, which defaults in each scenario to 1 times 10 to the minus 6 cancer risk, the number of years and days an individual is assumed to be exposed, the amount of time an individual spends indoors and outdoors, and the amount of soil an individual is assumed to ingest. Okay, let's go to slide 67. This slide continues the list of PRG parameters that may be modified, including the shielding a house provides from gamma radiation emanating from the soil, the amount of dust an individual is assumed to inhale, the adjustments that can be made for gamma radiation at sites covering a smaller area, and the amount of contaminated food an individual is assumed to eat. Okay, now we can turn to slide 68. We can see the risk pathways that are used for calculating PRGs for an agricultural exposure scenario, which is essentially a resident farm family with lots of homegrown food. More specifically, the agricultural PRG includes the pathways found in the residential scenario and the risk from eating contaminated fish from an on-site fish pond, the risk from eating contaminated beef, pork, and chickens that are grown on-site, the risk from eating eggs laid by contaminated chicken, and lastly, the risk from drinking milk from a contaminated cow. Okay, let's turn to slide 69. I'm going to give you a couple of seconds to see how the very complicated formula for the agricultural scenario looks like when you view it using a PRG calculator. Okay, before we start going blind looking at this, let's move on to slide 70. This slide shows the risk pathways that are used for calculating PRGs for a commercial industrial worker exposure scenario. The industrial soil PRG includes the risk to a worker from direct ingestion of contaminated soil, the risk from inhaling windblown contaminated dust, and the risk from external radiation from gamma-emitting radionuclides in soil. Okay, let's move on to slide 71 now. Okay, you can see how the formula for the outdoor industrial worker appears when using the PRG calculator. The outdoor worker represents a full-time employee of a company operating on-site and who spends most of the workday conducting maintenance activities outdoors. Okay, well, now let's move on to slide 72. You see here the formula for the indoor industrial worker, how it appears when using the PRG calculator. The indoor worker represents an employee who spends most, if not all, of the workday indoors. Okay, I think we're ready to go to slide 73. This slide shows the risk pathways that are used for calculating PRGs for a resident using the tap water exposure scenario. The tap water PRG includes the risk from direct ingestion of contaminated water and the risk from inhaling radionuclides that are volatilized from water use in the home. Okay, move on to slide 74. Once again, you can see how one of the formula appears when using the PRG calculator. In this instance, it's the tap water PRG. Okay, let's move on to slide 75. Okay, we see the formula in the PRG calculator for estimating the risk to an individual who eats a lot of radioactively contaminated fish. All right, let's turn to slide 76. You can see the formula for the movement of radionuclides from soil to groundwater through the vadose zone. These equations provide two simple and very conservative methods for deciding if leaching to groundwater is a potential concern. If using a simple screening methodology indicates your site may have a leaching problem, before actually cleaning up soil to address the potential for soil leaching, you may want to review Part 3 of the Technical Background Document, or TBD, for the Soil Screening Guidance for Radionuclides. This chapter contains an evaluation of 5 more sophisticated soil-to-groundwater models. By obtaining more site-specific information concerning the site's hydrogeology and running one of these models, you may develop soil-to-groundwater PRGs that are more accurate. All right, let's move on to slide 77. We can see the toxicity values for plutonium-239 and generic PRG concentrations if you use the defaults while running the PRG calculator for various exposure scenarios. I'm showing the results for plutonium-239 on this page, since this is the radionuclide for which we showed a variety of cleanup levels in Module 2 earlier. All right, let's turn over to slide 78. You now see a picture of how EPA's radionuclide dose cleanup concentrations calculator looks when you go to the webpage. We often refer to this as the ARAR dose calculator. It is important to note here that it's EPA's policy that at surplus sites, cleanup levels should be selected using risk derived from slope factors, not millirem derived from dose conversion factors, except when cleanup levels are based on ARARs. Dose assessments should only, and I can't stress that word enough, only be conducted at surplus sites to demonstrate ARAR compliance. Okay, turning to slide 79. The ARAR dose calculator is set up in a similar manner to the PRG calculator. It includes the same exposure scenarios, except it leaves out the soil to groundwater scenario. The equations of the scenarios are essentially the same, except the ARAR dose calculator uses dose conversion factors instead of slope factors, and a year of peak dose instead of risk over a period of exposure such as 30 years for residential land use. The ARAR dose calculator does include both ICRP 26 and 60 dose conversion factors. EPA recommends that ICRP 60 dose conversion factors be used for ARAR compliance unless the ARAR specifies some other dose conversion factors as a requirement. Before leaving this module, I want to mention that both the PRG and ARAR dose calculators include an online user guide. These user guides provide information not only in using the calculator, but also on the sources, such as default parameters used in the calculators. Okay, this now concludes Module 3. I'm going to turn over the role of presenter back to Carl Spring to take you through our final module, Module 4. Carl, it's all yours.
Thanks, Stuart. If you'll now go with me to slide 80, this is the Module 4 that presents an example application of the PRG risk calculator that Stuart just described to us in Module 3. And if you'll then go to the next slide, 81, there are three approaches that we present here in this module used for PRG calculations at this example site. This is a hypothetical site, but actually these numbers were really calculated by an actual site, that will leave nameless, but these actually were performed at a site using the calculator. First of all, the calculations were done with the standard RAGS Part B, which is based on EPA's risk assessment guidance for Superfund, or RAGS, developed in 1992. This guidance documents the process of how to develop PRGs, but it doesn't include a list of PRG values. But this guidance, RAGS Part B, is the source for the original PRG equations. Then second, the PRG calculator using default values. These default parameters are taken from EPA's soil screening guidance for RADs that Smita first mentioned to us, that was developed back in the year 2000. None of the parameters have been modified, including location, for this calculation. Then the third calculation is using the PRG calculator with site-specific parameters. They've been changed to reflect the example site's specific conditions, and you'll see that coming up in slides 86 and 87 when we get to them. So the next slide is 82, and this lists screen levels that were calculated for 11 radionuclides, including the PRG calculator with the default parameters. These are intended to be a representative mix of radioisotopes from actinium to uranium, some with long half-lives and some with short. Now the next slide shows some of the results, again using RAGS Part B and comparing those to the RAG calculator, PRG calculator with default values. And let me just point out a few items on this table. First of all, the radionuclide PRG calculator with default inputs generally yields a higher PRG value than the RAGS Part B method for all these selected radionuclides except for iodine, plutonium, and strontium. Actinium-228 and lead-212. For these two, the default PRG is four orders of magnitude higher than the RAGS Part B-derived PRG. And down at the bottom, uranium-235, there essentially is no significant difference between the PRG numbers for those for that radioisotope. The difference here is largely due to the effects of radioactive decay. And the next slide, slide 84, some of the changes for the new EPA RAD PRG's guidance include, first of all, the use of an area correction factor of 0.9 to correct for a small lot size. Now, an individual is exposed to a radiological source geometry that is effectively an infinite slab. The concept of an infinite slab means the thickness of the contaminated zone and its aerial extent are so large that it behaves as if it were infinite in its physical dimensions. For very small areas of contamination, that will result in an overly conservative estimate of risk. So for the calculation of PRGs, an adjustment for source area is considered to be an important modification for Superfund sites. Therefore, this area correction factor has been added. Two, the assumption of indoor time spent by the resident has been changed from 15 hours to 16.4 hours. 1.75 hours of outdoor time has been added. And three, changing the default gamma shielding factor from 0.8 to 0.4. The EPA determined that a default gamma shielding factor of 0.4 based solely on the contribution of terrestrial radiation would be more appropriate value to use at sites with soil contaminated with radionuclides than the previous EPA default of 0.8, which also included the effects of cosmic radiation and the inherent radioactivity in structural materials. And the fourth assumption is the use of the adult-only slope factor for soil ingestion for the industrial worker. That's because it's inappropriate to use soil factors that include health effects to children or infants for exposure scenarios that only affect adults. There's some more assumptions on the next slide, 85. The incorporation of a first-order radioactive decay term over the exposure duration for radionuclides in soil. Now, if you have the printed speaker notes, you can see that first-order decay term in the calculator equations. And it includes, just to let you know, there are factors that include the duration of the radionuclide decay in years and a lambda factor, which is based on the radionuclide half-life. The sixth assumption is the addition of an inhalation exposure route for soils due to wind-blown dust with the use of an indoor air dilution factor of 0.4. And seven, addition of an inhalation exposure route for tritium, carbon-14, radium-224, radium-226, and radium-226 plus daughters in the tap water calculations. On the next slide, 86, is an example of industrial worker assumptions. And here are the differences between the PRG calculator default values and the assumptions used to set up the example site-specific industrial worker scenario. First of all, the example industrial worker scenario is a blend of the EPA indoor worker and the EPA outdoor worker scenarios. Second, the hypothetical industrial worker is assumed to work outdoors 65% of his time. And third, the incidental soil ingestion rate was changed to 65 milligrams per day, and that corresponds to 65% of his time outdoors. 65% of 100 milligram default outdoor worker ingestion rate is 65 milligrams per day. On the next slide, there's some more assumptions. the assumption of outdoor time changed to 5.2 hours. 65% of an 8-hour day is 5.2 hours. And the next one is the assumption of indoor time was changed by applying the 35%, the remainder of the time of an 8-hour day is 35% of 8 or 2.8. The next slide, 88, is another comparison table. Again, we have the two columns showing RAGS Part B parameters, and the middle column showing parameters from the DRG calculator default outdoor worker parameters. And now we have added a third column with the adjustments made for the site-specific industrial worker. And a few things to point out here. For actinium 228, the calculated derived PRG is 5 orders of magnitude higher than the RAGS Part B derived PRG. Again, at the bottom, the uranium 235 values, there's essentially no significant difference between the PRG numbers. And there's very little difference between the default outdoor worker PRGs and example industrial worker PRGs. In other words, adding time indoors had very little effect. The next slide is 89. Here's a list of some of the sensitive parameters. By far the most sensitive parameter modification was the incorporation of radioactive decay into the EPA PRG calculator. This increased the resulting PRGs up to 5 orders of magnitude above the RAGS Part B method, which didn't allow for radioactive decay. And then the other three parameters, changing the area correction factor, the gamma shielding factor, and exposure duration combined to increase PRG values above values derived from RAGS Part B method, but only slightly. And slide 90. This describes next steps to be taken. This is after PRGs have been calculated for the radionuclides of concern. One next step is if soil measurements in a certain area do not exceed PRGs, then generally no further action would be required. The PRG calculator is therefore a quick way, quick and simple way to eliminate areas of site from any further action. But if the soil measurements exceed the PRG, then additional actions may be necessary. First of all, you could do additional site evaluation, and that could include collect additional data. You could conduct additional studies to determine site-specific environmental variables. You might choose to aggregate the data over appropriate areas of concern or exposure units. You can use statistical parameters of the aggregated data to compare to PRGs. For example, the 95% upper confidence limit of the mean of the aggregated data. You might use probabilistic methods to determine sensitive parameters. And you might use geostatistical methods to show how contaminant levels are related spatially and to determine the best spots for additional sampling. Now, all of those have been used at various sites that we've studied in the report that we did. Next, you might determine site-specific remediation goals. And remember, PRGs maybe are preliminary, but you might use them and they might be adjusted to become final cleanup goals. Third steps you could take, you might determine that you need to remediate the site. And that could be based on preliminary or the final remediation goals. And it may be decided that as part of the remedy, the site should impose institutional controls as necessary. That concludes the final module, Module 4, and we'll now have the second question and answer portion of the training, and Juliana will again moderate that session.
Thank you, Carl. If you move to slide 91, that's our question and answer slide, but I'm actually going to ask you to go ahead and move forward to slide 92. Before we go to our questions, I'd like to take you to the links to additional resources. So if you select that website listed on the slide, and this resource will continue to be available after today's training course. The first link that I want to point out is along the left-hand side under the Clue and Sun, the third item listed is the feedback form. and I will encourage you to fill out that feedback form and leave us comments. The ITRC RADS team is working on a new training class that Carl mentioned on D&D, so if you have comments that you would like to have them think about as they're developing that class, we do appreciate your feedback. Looking to the right, you can see the links to additional resources. In Section 1 are the ITRC-specific links. The first link allows you to download the presentation that was used today. In addition to what you've seen on the screen, there's more materials available in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded version. The next items listed are the documents that the team, the ITRC RADS team, has created. And if you select those blue buttons, that's going to take you over to the ITRC website, where you can either download a PDF of the document or order a hard copy of, and currently there's 4 different documents available from the ITRC RADS team. In Section 2, we have some EPA Superfund resources. If you scroll down, you can see Section 3, where we have more EPA non-Superfund this time. In Section 4 are other resources. And Section 5 takes you back to the ITRC website. And I do want to point out at this time that we have another training class from the ITRC RADS team, this one on June 5th, Radiation Site Cleanup, Circular Requirements and Guidance. If you connect to the ITRC website and select Internet-based training, that's going to take you to where you can find out more about that and register for that class. We do now want to take time to have questions. If you're in our phone line audience, remember to unmute your phone, and that's *7 if you've used our system. For our simulcast audience, it's the orange question mark at the top of the slide. And I am going to start with a question from our simulcast audience, and this refers to slide 77. Can the speaker address the significance of the different values that appear on slide 77? What does this mean for overall PRGs applying it to site cleanup needs? And this question is from Lisa Treckel at DOEEM in Germantown, Maryland.
Well, this slide gets at what Carl was talking a lot about in Module 1, which is basically, you know, land use assumptions have a lot to do with what your PRGs are going to come up to. There may be some site-specific hydrogeologic information or other information regarding human behavior that you have site-specifically, but a big driver when you're looking at the same risk level, and keeping in mind that the risk range that you might use for final cleanup could be between 10 to minus 6 or 10 to minus 4, so that's 2 orders of magnitude. But this is just showing quickly how land use has such a big effect, or can have such a large effect on cleanup levels, or in this case for PRGs at 10 to minus 6. Now, Carl, do you want to add anything about that?
No, what I would like to add is a little bit better explanation for the last question we had from the last question-answer period. If I could quickly just add something, that was Joe Eidelberg, I believe, from Region 9. I had a chance to go back quickly and compare those numbers, and the numbers for the residents from those two sites, the Lawrence Livermore and the Johnson Atoll, actually aren't very different. The resident, the numbers we would compare there would be the 2.5 and 1.9, which is the 10 to the minus 6 number in the chart. So they're not very different, and those are fairly comparative with other values calculated from other sites for residents. As I think Smith mentioned, Johnson Atoll used fairly conservative numbers for, in some cases, for ingestion, soil ingestion, for example. They used a number that soil ingestion rate that was 4 times the EPA's recommended value in the exposure factors handbook. So they used fairly conservative, and they came up with numbers that were a little more conservative, a little smaller than at Lawrence Livermore, but they're in the same range.
Thank you. Do we have a question from our phone line audience?
I had a question about slide 83.
Yes, and you are?
Shaley from New York.
Thank you, Shaley.
And I just was wondering if Stuart could elaborate on the effect of taking into account radioactive decay on the differences between the cleanup levels
I would think that taking into account daughter products would lower the cleanup levels rather than raising the cleanup levels.
I'll take the first stab. I think Carl, this, and Carl Sexton can also add to that. For a short-lived radionuclide, just what you're going to have at year one, the level of activity is going to be much less, say, at year 30. So if you have something that's got, say, a five-year half-life, it's going to, you're going to have gone through several half-life cycles.
Okay.
Now, you are correct, though, for some of the radionuclides where you have, you'll see, you compare some of the numbers where it's the radionuclide, then you have the radionuclide with the plus D. Sometimes, you know, the plus D is more stringent because the ingrowth of the daughter products is giving you higher risk than just the initial radionuclide. So, but overall, if you had to look overall 800, I mean, adding in the decay to EPA's methodology would generally be a lowering of risk. And I should also say, too, before the PRG calculator came out, people were using plus D slope factors for those that where the risk would be greater with the daughter product. So the adding of decay was kind of a, at least for EPA's methodology, was kind of a one-way street where it became, either didn't change anything if it was a long-lived radionuclide or it made things less stringent by adding more realism by accounting for the decay. I don't know, Carl, if you want to add to that.
Well, there are, and I think she's right, it's not apparent there the effect of adding the decay of the daughters, but there are other factors that change from 1989 up to 2000, or 2002, and those account for the changes as well.
Yeah, I guess if we were going to look at the change of adding in daughters, it would have been a comparison with, say, cesium-137 and cesium-137 plus D, and the same thing with radium-226, looking at the table on 83.
Similarly, I was just wondering if you could elaborate again, and I think I missed it, on the change of the default gamma shielding factor from 0.8 to 0.4. You had explained it, but I don't think I caught it, why that change occurred. This is slide 84.
Carl had mentioned that. I remember that change was made in the soil screening guidance for radionuclides, and it was based on updated data that, on further thought, was more considered to be much more accurate or better default than the earlier value. So the earlier value had been taken in from RAGS, and I can't remember the original source, but I know there were some issues about its appropriateness for site cleanup.
Well, okay. I mean, I think the ResRad default value for the shielding factor is 0.7, and that is a significant difference.
It is, and I
believe 0.4.
I believe that's, the ResRad's has changed over the years too. Is that the latest?
I think that's the late 90s. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
Yeah, because they've gone through another iteration since then.
Okay.
I'm not sure what they're about. I don't know what their default is on the gamma.
But the original factor, 0.8, as we mentioned, it included the effects of cosmic radiation and...
I see. And this is only for soil.
Materials. Right.
I see.
Yeah, okay. I knew that was something weird with that.
Okay, so it's taking out cosmic radiation.
And from structural materials, from, building materials.
Okay.
Yeah, it is based on a different study. If you look, when you look back at the soil screening guidance, it references a different study than the one that was used back in RAGS.
And what is the reference? This would be in the which document would this be in?
It's going to be the Phillips greeting guide. If you when you go to the PRG calculator, there's a in the user guide. There's a table one that's most probably 4/5 of the way back. Goes on for a couple pages, and it gives each of the default parameters that's in the calculator and the source.
Okay.
And should also have, say, the page number, and it may just reference the soil screening guides for radionuclides, in which case then you have to look at that page of the soil screening guides. If you're not able to find it, I mean, I can always email it to you, but I'm not sure if it references both. It probably just references the soil screening guides.
Okay. This is Juliana, and I'm sorry, we are out of time. For our simulcast participants, we are going to follow up with you on your questions that we didn't get to. I'm sorry that we didn't have time to get to those. I'd like to thank our instructors and participants for joining us on today's training class. If you have not already, please fill out the feedback form. It's a great way to communicate with us. The ITRC website is available at www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again, and have a great day.